Every 6 minutes, a woman is diagnosed with gynecological cancer in the United States. That's over 90,000 new cases this year alone. And those cancers will cause 28,000 deaths, some of them as silent killers. That's because women are often unaware of the signs and symptoms until it's too late. So what should we be watching for? Which screening tests should we have? And how about prevention? Stand by. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. I'm Dr. Nerida. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. The most common gynae cancer is largely preventable and the most deadly is not. That's why recognizing the warning signs and acting on them are essential for long-term survival. Gina did just that, but still came perilously close.
I've always lived fairly healthfully, but for example, I've always been a vegetarian, but I do have a sweet tooth. And I would eat what I would want to eat, and I would exercise when I would feel like it. I probably didn't get as much sleep as I ought to, but overall, I was doing okay, and frankly, I didn't think a whole lot about my health because I hadn't had a whole lot of problems. I didn't think much about my age, but actually, I had turned 50, and I still felt pretty good, like maybe I was 30 or 35, but of course your body starts changing, especially for women. At that time, you start going into menopause, 51, and so I was reaching that age, and my menstrual cycle was changing, and I was having fewer and fewer periods, and then I just seemed to stop, and I thought, great, I'm done with that. And then a few months later, there was quite a lot of bleeding, and he was an OBGYN. I went to see him, and right away he did a biopsy. And then I will never forget one day when the phone rang, and he said, hi, this is Dr. K, and the results have come back, and they're suspicious. Well, there's a lot of cancer in my family, and I know immediately what suspicious means. And it seemed surreal to me that this happens to other people, but not to me. And I went in, and he said, we need to do a further procedure, a D&C, and so we did that. And the results came back, and they said, oh, there's no problem. And I said, really, there's no problem? Then why did we get the results of the biopsy that it looks suspicious? And my doctor agreed, and he said, you know, I'm going to send this for a second opinion, which he did, and he sent me to a gynecological oncologist. And he looked at the results, and he said, they can't tell exactly what the problem is, but there's a problem. So we are going to go ahead and see and act like we know for sure exactly that this is cancer. We're going to treat it just like that. So we went in. I had all the pre-prep, and we did a complete hysterectomy. The results came back from the lab work on that. And I'll never forget that doctor. He said, I'm so glad that we did that. I'm so glad because it was cancer and it was endometrial cancer. And in fact, the cancerous tumor was just 2 millimeters from being uncontained.
That's a little too close for comfort. Stay with us for the rest of Gina's story on today's show, along with a spicy smoothie, a wonderful workout, and two experts who talk about the range of cancers from which women need to protect themselves. But first, the news. In the headlines today, smoking more lethal than previously thought, excess body fat now associated with cancer of cervix and ovary, and soy carries protection from ovarian cancer. A new study shows the true estimate of smoking-related deaths is 17% higher than previously thought. Analysis of almost 1 million adults showed that smoking increased the risk of dying from breast cancer by 30%, prostate cancer by 40%, and of bowel ischemia by 500% when compared with non-smokers. Deaths from infections, renal failure, lung diseases, and hypertensive heart diseases all doubled in smokers. And the more an individual smoked, the higher the risk. For former smokers, the longer the time since quitting, the greater the benefit. So if you smoke, enjoy the benefits of quitting today. Recent reports suggest, for the first time, that being overweight increases women's risk of ovarian cancer and cervical cancer. These add to the growing list of cancers now linked to excess body fat, including cancers of the colon, the pancreas, kidneys, esophagus, gallbladder, thyroid, uterus, and for postmenopausal women, cancer of the breast. So ladies, there's yet another benefit to maintaining a healthy weight. A new study from China suggests that phytoestrogen intake is protective against ovarian cancer. The results of 10 epidemiological studies were pooled and showed a higher phytoestrogen intake to be associated with a 30% reduction in risk of ovarian cancer. Researchers subgrouped the studies by type, source of phytoestrogen, and region, and found that soy foods and an Asian diet reduced the risk by half. So as Hippocrates once said, let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's health news. On today's show, I'm joined by two cancer specialists, Dr. Gotham Rao and Dr. Dana Roquet. They are both assistant professors working in gynecologic oncology at the University of Maryland Medical Center in Baltimore. I asked Dr. Rao to explain where cancers can arise in the female reproductive tract.
So unfortunately, women can get cancers at any point in the female reproductive tract, starting from the ovaries and then down to the fallopian tubes, then further down to the uterus, also the cervix, which is the opening of the uterus, and then the vagina and the vulva, which is the outside of the vagina.
Now, which are the most common?
Uterine cancer is the most common.
And then which would be?
Then it would be ovarian cancer followed by cervical cancer.
So we should probably focus on those three today. How many women, Dr. Roque, would be affected by some kind of gynecological malignancy in their lifetime?
So at least in the United States alone, we know that there are about 21,000 new cases of ovarian cancer annually. There, across worldwide, there are over 200,000. Looking at endometrial cancer cases, there are probably over 50,000 in the United States and over 300,000 worldwide. And we're fortunate in the United States because we have a method for screening for cervical cancer. So the rate of cases per year is about 12,000 in our country. However, worldwide, there are over 500,000.
So we're talking about screening tests. Dr. Rao, explain why some cancers we can screen for and some we can't.
So cervical cancer does have a screening test because a pap smear can be done without too much difficulty and cost to the patient. Unfortunately, we don't have a screening test for ovarian cancer because we haven't found one that's good enough, meaning that it's not specific enough for ovarian cancer. So oftentimes it will pick up women that don't have ovarian cancer or have a benign ovarian cyst, and then those women might need to undergo necessary further tests or procedures.
So if they got, what say, a false positive test, then they'd be very anxious and then subsequently find out that actually it was benign, and so you'd cause more, it would be more trouble than it was worth. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and unfortunately that would be a large number of women that would undergo that anxiety and further testing and possibly even surgery.
So it comes down to cost, the ease at which you can do the test, the accuracy of the test, and whether it shows positive when it shouldn't be, and things like that. So that's quite a complex combination of factors. to find a screening test. So you're saying there's no screening test for ovarian cancer?
No.
There is one for cervical, but what about for the uterus? Is there a screening test for that?
There is not a screening test for uterine or which we often refer to as endometrial cancer, because most cancers in the uterus arise from the endometrium or the inner lining of the uterus. Fortunately, most women that have endometrial cancer will have either abnormal bleeding, or if they've gone through menopause already, they would have postmenopausal bleeding. And most of these cancers are detected early.
So it sort of doesn't need a screening test.
Yeah, so there hasn't been a big push for a screening test.
After the break, it's time for a treat, but first, this. Things don't seem to be improving. Are you eating the way I recommended?
Yes.
And drinking plenty of water?
Yes.
And exercising?
Yes, I'm doing everything you told me to do faithfully every day. I'm not drinking alcohol. I'm not doing all that other bad stuff you told me not to do.
Well, then maybe this is spiritual.
Come on, Doc. Spirituality, faith have nothing to do with health.
Oh, yes, they do.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, there was the study of 22 kibbutzim, 11 secular, 11 religious, and they followed them for 16 years. They were matched demographically for age and gender and all those things. The death rate on the secular kibbutzim, 3 times higher than that on the religious kibbutzim.
Oh, but that's got nothing to do with faith. That was probably just a fluke, Doc.
Well, consider this. Dr. Krukoff took cardiac patients. I mean, these were critical patients. And one group received music, touch, and prayer.
You've got to be kidding me, Doc. That's a bit touchy-feely, isn't it?
Well, the group that got the prayer and the therapy, they had fewer complications, did better overall.
Oh, well, maybe there is something to this faith thing. You know, matter of fact, I heard last week that those who learn to forgive, they have lower blood pressure, lower anxiety, and lower depression.
And God is the perfect role model of forgiveness.
So I guess you're right. A doctor should treat body, mind, and spirit. Thanks, Doc.
You're welcome. Don't leave God off your prescription. We're back, and it's the best time of the show. We get to eat. And Phil's with us. Phil, how are you today?
I'm doing great, especially since we're going to eat.
Oh, yeah. So what are we going to eat today?
Well, I love things that are flavored with pumpkin. And so for this, I brought a pumpkin smoothie.
Oh, yum. Never had that before. So what's in it?
It's very basic. It starts out with one 15-ounce can of pumpkin puree, 2 cups of plant milk, 2 cups of ice, 2 tablespoons of maple syrup, 1 tablespoon of vanilla, and 1 tablespoon of pumpkin pie spice. Mm. And the great thing about this recipe is you just put these all together, blend them, and you're done.
Sounds great. And that's a whole meal, isn't it?
That is.
And it's filled with antioxidants. Look at the color of that pumpkin.
And the one thing that you want to keep in mind is we're going to put a lot of, we're going to put a little bit of sweetener in. But the problem is that if you buy pumpkin that's already pureed in cans, a lot of times you get a lot of those sweeteners.
Right.
You get too many. So make sure that you get the natural pumpkin. Don't get the overly sweetened canned stuff.
Right, because then you can control how much sweetener you put in, especially for someone with diabetes. You know, you just don't want your sugars to go sky high and not realize why, and you won't have adjusted for it with your medication.
So we put the pumpkin in? Yes.
Using maple syrup, but you could use agave, you could use rice syrup, other sweeteners.
And you can also leave it out if you want something that doesn't have it, if you want to cut it out a little bit, or even just trim it back.
Right. And you could even use honey.
So this is our spices, and that's basically just cinnamon, nutmeg, and allspice.
Mmm.
And then we have vanilla in here. And to our viewers, I'm sure it looks a little bit different. A lot of times you see the liquid. Yeah. This is powder form. So it's kind of a fun way to do it.
Yeah, we're cheating today. And milk.
And milk. Now, this is soy milk.
Okay.
You can use almond milk. You can use whatever type you prefer.
Yeah, you can use rice milk.
And then we need the ice.
Milk. Right. This always makes... This is the secret ingredient to smoothie. You know, if you miss this out, your smoothie turns out, in my opinion, a little bit boring.
It does. It gives it a texture that I love. And then all we need to do is just blend it.
Okay.
This looks pretty
good. Yeah, it does. The ice gives it a great taste. It somehow gives the flavor a real kick, and then it makes it nice and smooth.
You know, you see a lot of pumpkin recipes around. I find it kind of interesting that pumpkin used to be considered sort of the dish of last resort, and now it's become quite a delicacy that I love.
Well, and when I lived in England, they fed it to the pigs. But that is such a waste of good pumpkin. That is fantastic. You have got to make this.
Good.
This is so easy. You just throw it all in and bam, it's done. Thanks, Phil. Great recipe.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I love pumpkin. In the first segment, Gina had abnormal bleeding that eventually proved to be uterine cancer. By the time the gynecologist removed her uterus, the tumor was only 2 millimeters from breaking through the capsule. That's a close call.
I was really, really thankful. And because of the location of where it was, they decided to follow up with radiation treatments. So we did that. And but in addition to this, as far as lifestyle, I realized that I really shouldn't take my health for granted. And I realized, in fact, that my body and my life did not belong to me, that I was created, that I really belonged to God. And I had a responsibility to live for Him, to keep my body as healthy as possible. Now, I'm not saying if I had done everything right, I wouldn't have gotten the cancer. I might have. But on the other hand, I am sure that taking better care of my body, eating more healthfully, cutting down on the sugar, being more intentional about exercise and getting enough sleep and fresh air and so on, I'm sure that made a difference in my recovery and how I feel today. I feel great. And while it was a difficult experience, it was actually a wake-up call for me that lifestyle, a healthy lifestyle, really matters and really makes a difference. It's been 2 years since my cancer diagnosis, and I'm now cancer-free. I used to eat a fair bit of cheese. I love cheese, actually. It's so good tasting. But I thought, you know, I could probably stop the cheese because I know it's an easy way to put on weight, eating cheese and milk products and that kind of thing. So I decided to go vegan, and I can really tell a difference. Now, I must say, once in a while I'll have a little bit of ice cream, but the emphasis on a little bit, not a whole lot. And I feel really good about that. I eat less processed foods. I try to eat more naturally, more fruit and vegetables, whole grains, and that kind of thing. And again, I can tell a difference. It's real.
The difference is really real, and it doesn't matter what kind of cancer you have. It's never too late to change your lifestyle. Ovarian cancer has been called the silent killer because it's usually diagnosed after it's spread beyond the ovaries. However, looking back on their symptoms, many women identify a cluster of complaints. And if they'd known, they could have found it sooner. So Dr. Roque is about to tell us what to look for.
Often in retrospect, many of these women who are diagnosed with an advanced ovarian cancer will recall some symptoms of bloating, early satiety or feeling full with meals earlier than they would have expected. They can often have abdominal pain that's diffuse, sort of nonspecific symptoms that they often ignore for a very long period of time before seeking help.
So the pain isn't so severe that they rush to the doctor that day.
Exactly.
It's just a niggling, grumbling pain that simply doesn't go away.
Sure, and it can be accompanied by changes in bowel habits, constipation, and other symptoms that are a bit nonspecific.
But you put it all together and it becomes more specific because they've got
the constellation.
Constellation of symptoms.
Absolutely.
So, Dr. Rao, talking about ovarian cancer, are there some women that would be more at risk than others?
There are women, including those that have a familial history or other women or even men in their family that have breast cancer or other cancers. This would predispose to genetic syndromes like the BRCA or BRCA syndrome.
Okay. And we can think of some famous Hollywood people that have those particular genetic issues, the mutations. Any other particular risk factors, Dr. Roque?
Oh, well, we know some things that are protective against ovarian cancers. So women who have been maintained on oral contraceptive pills tend to have protection from developing ovarian cancers later in life.
So the pill sort of switches their ovaries off. Their ovaries have a holiday for those years that they're on the pill, and therefore they've got an element of protection.
Right, there's a theory referred to as the theory of incessant ovulation, where the process is found to be irritating to the ovary and is essentially a catalyst for the development of an ovarian cancer. However, there are some more recent theories to dispute that.
Okay. Now, Dr. Rao, you mentioned that there's no screening test for ovarian cancer. So how do you go about detecting it?
So we would recommend that if a woman has persistent symptoms that Dr. Roque mentioned, like bloating or change in bowel habits or change in urinary symptoms, change in ability to eat, weight loss, we would recommend that they see their primary physician or gynecologist, and then screening tests such as a pelvic ultrasound could be done.
So pelvic ultrasound, anything else? Are there blood tests that can be done?
There is a blood test called a CA125, which is a tumor marker for ovarian cancer, but it's not elevated in every case.
All right, but maybe the cluster, and if it was elevated, it might be more. But your real test is your ultrasound scan, is that what you're saying?
Yes, ultrasound scan, and the ultimate test would be either a biopsy or surgery to confirm the diagnosis.
All right, so surgery would be the next step. Dr. Roque, explain what that would involve.
So ovarian cancer is a surgically staged disease, which means that women undergo an operation to remove the ovaries in conjunction with the uterus, the cervix, the fallopian tubes, as well as a sampling of the lymph nodes in the pelvis and surrounding the great vessels of the abdomen, known as the periaortic lymph nodes. Because ovarian cancers tend to spread or metastasize to the omentum, which is a fat pad that we all have in our abdomens, an omentectomy is often performed as well.
So that's quite major surgery, removing the ovaries, the tube, the uterus, mm-hmm. the cervix. So women who get ovarian cancer would not be able to have children.
That is true after this sort of surgery.
What would, is there chemotherapy, radiation, anything that would follow surgery for someone with ovarian cancer?
It would most likely be chemotherapy. Radiation therapy is not very effective for ovarian cancer. Fortunately, chemotherapy is very effective, and most women, even when they have metastatic ovarian cancer, which means it's spread outside of their ovaries, usually the spread is within their peritoneal or abdominal cavity, most women will go in complete remission after finishing surgery and chemotherapy.
And Dr. Roque, how long might that remission last for? When you say remission, they're now disease-free, apparently, if you were to look inside, is that right?
Right. So as Dr. Rao had mentioned, the vast majority of patients, we can achieve remission. And then these are patients who are then seen every 3 months for physical exams and also followed with serial CA-125 levels to detect the possibility of recurrence. The interval is different for every woman, but a lot of women will recur within 12 months to 18 months.
So it's a disease that is pretty persistent and it comes back. That's fairly quick. Yeah. So Dr. Rao, what would, I know we talk in, with cancers, we talk in terms of 5-year survival. So what percentage of women having the initial surgery would have a 5-year survival rate? What is it?
So the median survival rate would be around 5 years. Over time, it has improved with new technology, especially new chemotherapy medications. And obviously, over time, we hope to push that out even further.
Recurrence within 12 months, survival of 5 years following chemo, that's not a good prognosis. So here are some preventive strategies specifically for ovarian cancer. Stay slim as a teen. Avoid gaining more than 40 pounds or 20 kilos as an adult. Breastfeed for as long as you can. If you need contraception, consider the oral contraceptive pill, at least for a few years. Avoid using hormone replacement therapy for too long, and the obvious, don't smoke. When it comes to food, eggs may be associated with an increased risk. In the Adventist Health Study, meat and cheese were clearly associated with an increased risk, while eating tomatoes and fruit were protective. When we come back, Sean will be here to get us moving. But before we go to break, consider this. In Mark chapter 5, Jesus is busy by the Lake of Galilee when he's summoned to heal the daughter of the richest, most influential man in town. So he begins to make his way up the hill to the wealthy suburbs, and word spreads along the way. One little downtown lady is sure that if she touches his coat as he goes by, she'll be healed. So she heads over and sits on the curb to wait, reflecting on the 12 years of private misery this heavy bleeding has cost her. No man wants a wife unable to provide intimacy, and even if she could be with a man, there'd be no chance of a baby, not with this much loss, which leaves her tired, anemic, and broke from the dozens of physicians taking all of her money to perform the most painful of procedures. She shudders and tries to forget, but the tears form quickly. For what? Nothing. They've only made her worse. She knows that soon she'll die, and before then she wants to be right with God, but being ritually unclean, she can't attend synagogue, even on Sabbaths. Does the rabbi still believe her? Same reason every week for 12 years? Probably not. She feels an outcast, invisible. She hears the crowd, looks up, and there he is, Jesus. She can't take her eyes off him. Pushing through the crowd with her feeble strength, she catches the hem of his coat and suddenly feels the thrill of health and vitality. Jesus also feels it and stops. Seeking her out in the crowd, he gives her his time and attention, time to hear her painful story. And when she's done, he says, "Daughter, your faith has made you whole. Go in peace, healed and restored." So it is for anyone who goes in need to Jesus and lays hold of him with a living faith. He sees you and understands your desperate need. Come to him just as you are with an earnest faith. And we're back. You're comfortable at home, but Sean is here to shift us out of comfort.
There
Sean,
you go.
What are you going to do to us today?
Well, we're going to use the stability balls.
Yep.
All right, I have mine, you have yours. And these are perfectly sized just for our heights and perfect for us. But before we get started, we're going to start with some jumping jacks, all right, just to get our body moving, get our heart rate up. Or you can run in place, or you can do like high knees, all right? So you can do some jumping jacks, I'll do high knees, all right? I would say for the average person, setting your timer for about 30 seconds, right?
Okay.
And just the more you get into it, the more your knees will get up a little bit higher. You can relax. You're gonna feel your heart rate go up a little bit higher in 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. And if you're working with a partner, then I will go to jumping jacks, you will go to high knees, all right?
Right.
For about a couple minutes, just get your body warmed up. All right, we're gonna take the stability ball, and we're gonna start with some crunches, all right? Everyone always asks, how do you get rid of this midsection?
Right? Yeah.
So let's just go back here and just keep it very, very, very simple. Hands right here, okay? And come all the way up. Sometimes you can go for time, or you can go for a certain amount of reps. I like to go for time because you just never know what you can do in that time frame. And if you were to repeat the exercise again, you could try to beat your first attempt, right? 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. That's working your whole entire abdominal area.
Yeah.
It is a challenge, all right? So now,
sure is.
You work that front area. Let's go over to the side area, all right? So what you're going to do is go next to your stability ball right here and literally put one leg out here and keep yourself stable and just go out. All the way out. You'll feel this entire oblique right here work. All the way out. Come in. All the way out and in. Now, the challenge here is right now we have our knee on the floor.
Uh-huh.
But as you get a little bit stronger, you can actually go right here and pick one leg up and go to the side. We're not going to challenge her.
Wow.
We're not going to try that today. All right. So again, yeah. 3 more reps.
That's one of those where don't try this at home.
4. Come on. 3, 2, and 1. We're going to get the next side as well, okay? So put the ball on the other side. Take a nice deep breath. Get that one leg out right here to the side and go out. 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. All right, last one working the whole entire abdominal area would be to put your elbows right here. Now, I normally like people to do the plank, which uh-huh. I'll show you an example of it, just like this, and hold it for about 30 seconds. It Ooh. Is a challenge. It is a challenge. I'm not gonna lie to you. But what you can do is start off here, mm-hmm. okay? Keep your body stable, all right? Keep your entire abdominal area tight. Bring it down toward the ball and gradually work your way up, all right? Push up. Breathe. You'll go here, and I'm going to be the trainer for a second. You hold that, all right? And 5. You know I can't count. 5, 4.
You're with me here.
3. Work it. 2, and 1. A great exercise to work the entire abdominal area. That is the plank. It is like taking it to another level, all right? Using the stability ball is a great way to challenge regular exercises because, you know, you can do the plank just like
right.
this, you know, where you're on, you know, push-up position and you're holding it just like this.
Yeah.
You know, or you're on your elbow, all right? But now putting it on the stability ball challenges all those small stabilizer muscles to now work to keep your body nice and stable and strong or to get it stronger.
So our viewers now know they can start with just on the
yeah.
floor and build up to the
yep.
stability ball.
So I'll show you the progression. You can start here on the elbow. Make sure you put a mat underneath you.
Mm-hmm.
30 seconds. You can even go where you're on your knee.
Yeah.
Right? If you're feeling a little bit stronger in your upper body area, almost like you're gonna do a push-up, but not doing the push-up. Right here. Don't do this. Right here. And then you can work your way into the stability ball.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thanks, Sean.
That is great. So again, 30 to 45 seconds of each exercise and keep repeating it. Do about 4 to 5, you know, rounds and have a blast.
Sounds great. Now, how do we stretch
out
our abdos?
Okay, so let's go here. Stand up. Take a nice deep breath all the way up and reach down. You're gonna feel it in your hamstrings a little bit, but you can still reach behind you a little bit, get a good stretch. Go to the other side, stretch out the obliques. Other side. Back to the middle. Come up nice and slow. There you go.
Great, thanks.
You're very welcome.
That feels good.
You're very welcome.
Heart disease is not just a man's disease. A study reported in the New England Journal of Medicine compared two groups of middle-aged women. The first group had 80% fewer heart attacks than the second. What was the difference? The first group were all a healthy weight, did not smoke, and exercised at least 30 minutes a day. These things, maintaining a healthy weight, not smoking, and exercising, were the triple advantage against heart disease. A healthy heart is another ageless advantage.
Now it's time for questions that have come in by Facebook, text and phone. Judy says, I'm 56 years old. Are there any supplements that I should take to help me with PMS and to avoid its side effects such as depression? I have constant insomnia. Well, at 56, you're unlikely to be premenopausal or have premenopausal syndrome because you should no longer be having menses or periods. If you are, you need to see your doctor to exclude uterine cancer. PMS comes as the result of hormone changes in the week or two prior to a period, resulting in mood swings, irritability, fluid retention, sugar cravings, bloating, breast tenderness, headaches, and constipation. The most effective natural therapy is to clean up your lifestyle all month long. No sugar, no processed foods, caffeine or alcohol, and limit dairy and meat. Regular meal times, control your stress, meditate daily, be physically active at least 5 days a week, and work on reducing body fat to less than 30%. Once all of that is in place, if you still have a problem, then add a few herbs or supplements. Calcium and magnesium, vitamin B6, pyridoxine and B12, evening primrose oil, at least 1,000 milligrams twice a day, 3 tablespoons of freshly ground flaxseed a day, and sometimes chasteberry berry extract can also be added. Someone else called and said, how do you feel about bioidentical hormones for a complete hysterectomy? I'm just trying to find something to balance out my hormones. Well, if you're under 50 and have had both your ovaries removed, then consider hormone replacement therapy for symptom control, but also it's good for your heart, for your bones, it reduces the risk of diabetes and death. So regardless of whether you use bioidentical hormones or not, if you have a personal or a family history of heart disease, blood clots, strokes, breast cancer or ovarian cancer, then you need to have a serious chat with your doctor. If none of those apply to you and you have a healthy lifestyle, then hormone replacement therapy will be beneficial until you're 55 or even 60 years old. Since you no longer have a uterus, you only need estrogen and not the progesterone. Avoid estrogen that's derived from horse's urine or mare's urine. Most drug companies nowadays, though, are making estrogen that is identical to the estrogen that your ovaries would be making if you had them, and therefore it's bioidentical. It's called estradiol, and you can get it on prescription. Well, thanks for those questions. Keep them coming. Now let's go shopping. Quinoa originated in the Andean region of South America, where it was domesticated 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. The Incas held the crop to be sacred, calling it the mother of all grains. However, during the Spanish conquest of South America, quinoa was scorned by the Spanish colonists as food for Indians, and its cultivation was actually forbidden. Instead, the Incas were forced to grow wheat. It's not a true grain because it's not a member of the grass family, but it's a grain crop with edible seeds that come as white, red, or in this case, black, depending on the cultivar. It's become popular in the US, Europe, China, and Japan, where it's not usually grown, and that's caused crop prices to triple, making it now 10 to 20 times more expensive than wheat. There are a number of reasons for its continued popularity. One, it's easy to digest, it has a high protein content, and it's a complete protein. It contains lots of fiber, phosphorus, magnesium, iron, and calcium. In fact, it's so good that NASA's exploring quinoa as a potential crop for long-duration human-occupied space flights. My use of quinoa is much more down-to-earth. I boil 2 cups of water with 1 cup of grain for 15 minutes, and when it cools, I fluff it with a fork
and serve it with a stir fry or in a salad. You can also germinate it and add the sprouts for an added value. Bon appetit.
In developing countries, cancer of the cervix is the most common gynecological cancer. In developed countries, it's endometrial cancer or cancer of the lining of the uterus. That's what Gina had. And that's because our lifestyle puts us at particular risk. Do you have obesity, diabetes, or high blood pressure? Then you're at risk. So listen up as Dr. Roque tells us about the symptoms.
The most common symptom is going to be postmenopausal bleeding. So women who have undergone menopause will present to their physician with complaints of anything from light spotting that's intermittent to passage of clots. This can be accompanied by some cramping and abdominal discomfort.
Now, what age are we talking about then? You're saying postmenopausal. What's the typical age of someone who is going to get endometrial cancer?
So there are a couple of different types of endometrial cancer, but overall, women are going to present in their 60s.
Now, are we seeing a shift in that age? I know where I've been practicing gynecology, we're seeing it more in the 50s and the 40s as women are getting heavier. And that can be complicated because they're just coming into the menopause. They don't know if they've stopped menstruating, whether this is abnormal. That can be a challenge. So do you have an age at which you would say abnormal bleeding or bleeding past a certain age could be a problem?
Right. So I look at the patient as a whole. And so if this is a woman who has risk factors of unopposed estrogen, secondary to overweight status or obesity, I have a much higher threshold to rule out cancer. And so if a woman over the age of 35 comes to me with complaints, I usually offer endometrial sampling, especially if she has those risk factors.
Dr. Rao, are there other risk factors apart from the weight problem? And you know, Alf, why does the weight carry that problem? Why does it have that unopposed estrogen effect?
So the adipose or fatty tissue all over our bodies, especially in women, secrete estrogen, which can then stimulate the endometrium and can make it have hyperplasia, which is precancerous, or unfortunately sometimes even cancer. There are other risk factors as well. They're similar to ovarian cancer risk factors, and these are women who have never been pregnant, who have not breastfed, who have not taken oral contraceptive pills. The exact cause is not known, but it's felt that the more menstrual cycles a woman has, and all of those things would decrease the number of menstrual cycles, the more menstrual cycles a woman have would increase her risk of endometrial cancer.
Okay. Now, I've also heard that high blood pressure and diabetes are risk factors as well. Is that true?
Yes. Diabetes and hypertension are risk factors, but those conditions usually are concurrent with obesity.
Right. So it's hard to tease out which came first, the chicken or the egg.
Yes.
Now, Dr. Roque, how do you diagnose? You mentioned the biopsy. Tell us how you make the diagnosis of endometrial cancer. Someone's come along, they've got the abnormal bleeding, they've perhaps got some of these risk factors. What would be the next step for them?
So women can be sampled in the office in many instances through an endometrial biopsy using a small instrument that's passed through the cervix and into the uterus in order to scrape out cells that can then be examined under the microscope by a pathologist. Not everyone is a candidate for that procedure. It can cause some discomfort, and sometimes the anatomy doesn't allow for it. And so in those instances, women are offered a DNC, or dilatation and curettage, where the entirety of the lining is removed for analysis, and we often also look with a camera or a hysteroscope inside the cavity.
Okay. Now, Dr. Rao, you mentioned the condition of hyperplasia. So if this biopsy is done, it could detect either the precancerous condition or the cancer?
Yes.
And how is the treatment different between the two?
So the treatment is individualized based on the type and extent of hyperplasia and the grade, which is the severity of the cancer. For most women, because they're postmenopausal and therefore don't desire future childbearing, the treatment would be a complete or total hysterectomy. For some younger women who desire to have children, then the treatment would be with progesterones, either pills or a intrauterine device which secretes progesterone.
So that's if they have the precancerous condition or even if they have cancer?
Even if they have cancer, as long as it's a low-grade cancer, one that we feel won't be overly aggressive.
Mm. So an early-stage, low-risk disease, you're talking the possibility of retaining the uterus, but someone who's finished their family, then you would be looking at a hysterectomy, Dr. O'Kay.
Yes.
And anything following the hysterectomy?
So again, it depends on the characteristics of the cancer itself. And so the things that we look at following surgery are the stage of the disease, exactly what cell type it involves, and then other microscopic features that may tell us that a patient will need therapy beyond surgery, and that can include various forms of radiation and in some instances chemotherapy.
Hmm. And Dr. Rao, we talked about the 5-year survival for ovarian cancer. How does endometrial cancer compare? What's 5-year survival like for these patients?
Endometrial cancer has an excellent 5-year survival, approximately 80%, and that's because most cases are caught early or stage one.
So catch it early, treat it promptly, and it's, if you had to choose a cancer, perhaps that would be one that would be one of the most favorable.
Yes, a low-grade, low-stage endometrial cancer is usually cured with surgery.
Just with that single operation?
Yes.
Well, that's a better prognosis. Join us after the break for the rest of Gina's story and to hear about the most preventable of all the cancers on today's show. And we're back with Gina. After a DNC that supposedly gave her the all clear, her doctor found cancer lurking deep in the wall of her uterus, so deep it had almost broken through. So after surgery came radiotherapy, but she wasn't content to leave it there. She then embarked on a completely plant-based whole food diet, and that's not all.
I've been more intentional about exercising. That area I'm still working on, to be honest, because I'm very busy and it is hard to work in time. But I have to remind myself that this is really important for my health, that our bodies were meant to move, and it's good to move. And so I will take the stairs instead of the elevator. I will walk far in the parking lot. And then in addition to that, I will try to go walking every day that I can and get good fresh air as well. There are a lot of people diagnosed each year with cancer, different kinds of cancer. And I would tell them, first of all, something that someone told me when I had my diagnosis, and that is, cancer is not the death sentence that it used to be. We know that it is serious, but I would encourage that person, do all you can. Do all you can for yourself as far as lifestyle. your diet, your exercise, your sleep, and all of that. But in addition, do what the doctor advises you to do. Do it in combination. I think that's the strongest way. And ultimately, the way to have peace, what I found, is again to realize that my life is not my own, that I belong to God, that I am in His hands. He created me. He will help me. He knows what is best for me, and to put my trust in Him, and I found real peace.
Finding real peace, despite the most scary of diagnoses, while doing all she could to prevent a recurrence, now that's a recipe for success. Cancer of the cervix occurs 20 times more often in Africa than it does in the United States. Here, Dr. Roque explains why.
We're lucky here in the United States that we have readily available in most instances the PAP, which is a screening test for cervical cancer. However, there are many parts of this country and other parts of the world where that's not readily available. And unfortunately, those are the areas where women are diagnosed with cervix cancer that might be advanced even at the time of initial presentation.
And Dr. Rao, tell us about the Pap smear. What is it and how effective is it at preventing cervical cancer?
So a Pap smear is generally done by a primary care physician or a gynecologist at the time of a pelvic exam. A speculum is inserted into the vagina, the cervix is visualized, and then a gentle scraping is done of the cervix to dislodge some cells, which are then examined under a microscope by a pathologist.
And is it pretty effective at preventing cancer?
It is a very good screening test. It usually detects most cancers. It does have some false positives in that women will have a positive Pap smear, which will lead to colposcopy or examination of the cervix with a microscope, which will then turn out fine.
So that doesn't sound painful. How often should a Pap be done, Dr. Roque? What are the recommendations?
So it depends on age group at this point. A number of national bodies recommend that Pap screening not begin until age 21. And then for the period of time between ages 21 through 29, these are women who undergo screening about every 3 years. After that point, so ages 30 and above, many women are candidates to have testing done as far apart as every 5 years if the Pap smear is performed in conjunction with HPV typing. Some other women who have cytology alone are still monitored at every 3 year intervals for that age category as well. And then by the time a woman becomes 65 years of age, as long as she doesn't have significant risk factors to continue screening, it's generally acceptable to stop at that point.
So this is a disease, cervical cancer is a disease of younger women. Now, Dr. Roque mentioned HPV. Tell us about HPV, Dr. Rao.
So HPV, or human papillomavirus, is a virus that almost everyone who's been sexually active has been exposed to. For most people, it does not cause any problems. For some women, unfortunately, it does cause cervical dysplasia, which is precancerous cells in the cervix, which can, if not detected and treated, can lead to cervical cancer.
So you're saying HPV is like a sexually transmitted disease and it carries the risk of cancer. Do you have symptoms with it? Can you tell you've got it?
So sometimes women will have post-coital bleeding or bleeding after intercourse, but in most cases it's asymptomatic and therefore we rely on the Pap smear for diagnosis.
So the Pap smear is done in conjunction with the HPV test. They're done together, you mentioned, Dr. Roque. So it's like two tests done at once, co-testing.
Yes, in many instances, that's a practice.
And how long does it take, if someone has HPV, how long would it take for them, and it's a high-risk subtype, mm-hmm. what's the length of time till it might cause cancer?
So this is why cervical cancer is often a very preventable disease, because it takes many, many years of HPV infection for the cells to undergo this abnormal change. So they go through various levels of dysplasia, which are first mild, then become moderate, severe, and then finally full-blown invasive cancer.
So there's a precancerous stage before you get to the cancer?
Yes.
And are there particular risk factors that a woman might have that would predispose to that change to cervical cancer? Because it can go either way. It can go backwards, can't it, rather than forwards. So are there risk factors that would promote the advancement of that process?
Some women do have risk factors for progression from cervical dysplasia to cervical cancer. And these include anything that would cause an immunocompromised state, such as HIV or an autoimmune condition that would require steroid therapy.
Dr. O'Kay, if HPV is the causative factor for most cervical cancer, is it possible to prevent HPV?
That's a great question. Actually, in recent years, a vaccine has been developed known as Gardasil, and it's now recommended for young girls age 9 through 26 to boost immunity against the two most common strains of HPV that are responsible for cervix cancer and genital warts.
So that's great. But probably the part of the world where the screening is not available also don't have availability to the vaccine. There must be quite a cost to the vaccine. Yeah,
that's true.
Yes, it is very expensive, unfortunately. So the women who are at highest risk for developing cervical cancer, you know, those women in developing countries, unfortunately, are least likely to get the HPV vaccine and to get Pap smear screening.
Mm. Now, let's move on. Let's say the diagnosis of cervical cancer has been made. What are the treatments for that?
So the treatments range from local excision of the cervix with biopsies and then surveillance to hysterectomy. And there's different types of hysterectomy based on the stage of cervical cancer. And for some women, hysterectomy is not beneficial because the cancer has spread beyond the cervix. And then we would recommend radiation therapy along with chemotherapy.
Cancer protection begins as a young person. The human papillomavirus vaccine is at least 70% protective against cancer of the cervix. And with HPV being a sexually transmitted disease, the fewer sexual partners a man or woman has, the less likely their risk for genital cancer. For protection against uterine cancer, maintain a healthy weight and lifestyle, thereby preventing the risk factors of obesity, diabetes, and hypertension. And ladies over 40, if you have abnormal bleeding, be sure to report it to your doctor immediately. Now, remember the cardinal signs of ovarian cancer: bloating, pain, having a poor appetite or feeling full too quickly, and finally, passing urine more frequently or more urgently than before, in which case you need to see your doctor and get an ultrasound scan as soon as possible. That's all from me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.